In this episode of Pop the Left, we're going to be talking about political Marxism. We're going to try to define what Pop the Left is about, right?
Yeah, I was about to say, we're talking about a debate between two sub forms of academic analysis within British Trotskyism. I mean, like, which seems kind of obscure. And I can add some additional context, you know, because it actually relates to a lot of different trends in Marxism in general.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a couple of things that the Davison Post, and I actually also read the original article and the various books behind it, get into that are super important. And I think people try today to bracket out. Usually because of like a threat to unity or whatever. And I think it's also interesting, for example, that these people are explicit that this disagreement would not bracket anyone out.
Okay.
But being in a Marxist movement.
Before we jump in full force with that argument, let's go through what else we're going to talk about.
The dictatorship of the proletariat.
Dictatorship of the proletariat. And as it comes out of my recent agreement to join Chris Catrone in the formation of a dictatorship of the proletariat.
Right.
And then I also want to bring up the topic of full disclosure and Posadism and the coming revolution from the new revolutionary subject, which will be the flying saucer people. But I think maybe we'll leave the Posadism stuff or my thrill and anticipation about the possibilities of full disclosure coming in June for the Parrot Room. Also for the Parrot Room, we will be talking about the Bellows again.
Yeah.
And the PMC, the professional managerial class, and the way that's being used today. I reread that article that we'd read once before, and I'm working on a Critical Cuts video. It's taking me longer than it should. And we'll talk about that in the Parrot Room. But just to start off here with the dictatorship of the proletariat, because I think that it connects maybe to the split within academic Trotskyism between the political Marxists and
the political Marxists and the historical materialist/more relatively orthodox Trotskyists.
Right.
And I always use a caveat because I'm uneasy calling anyone orthodox in anything because there's usually something in which they deviate. But
right,
but
like
yeah,
for me, the fact that I think that rather than the working class, the alien UFO occupants are the revolutionary subject, it might be considered by some to be a deviation.
A bit of revisionism, yes.
All right, so. But let's jump in with the dictatorship of the proletariat to begin with. And what did you, by the way, what did you think of my conversation with your former track coach, Chris Catrone?
Former Marxist track coach. I thought it was fine. I mean, there is a sense of.
I don't have to go to Gulag for having Riley.
There is a sense of like when there is no class for itself and in itself and you're. Yeah, at the same time, and you're focusing on the left response to that lack, you are kind of tailing different factions of the general political subject because the working class will also be tailing those battles because of sectional interest. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, I think Catrone actually hit on that maybe in a way that is not as flattering to him as maybe a lot of people think, but I also found it refreshingly honest. And he was, you know, I agree with him, for example, that no one's going to be able to dictate all the social and political norms of the working class in a dictatorship of the proletariat as a preliminary for being part of that movement, particularly if you believe that the dictatorship of the proletariat is a democratic class dictatorship and not something imposed as a fully fledged political brew plant upon the working class itself. So, you know, Catrone's absolutely right about that. Like there will be things that you have to work out in the working class. That, you know, I sometimes think a lot of this reframing culture wars, class wars, to avoid the fact that there isn't an automatic answer emerging from the working class itself on what the answers to a lot of these cultural questions could and should be. And I, you know, and I think like the quote PMC thesis or whatever is actually a way of avoiding that, avoiding that problem. I thought it was fine.
I just want to say, like, one thing about that, which is my attitude about cultural questions after the revolution, would be that in a society which is emancipated, the culture that would develop wouldn't be developing in as answers to questions, but as developments that are springing out of a new kind of freedom.
Right. You can't predict what any of this is going to be, right?
Like, but it wouldn't be a matter, you know, like some of the things that we can see in bourgeois society, I think would be taken for granted in a socialist society. Like, you know, you don't punish people for their speech. You know, that, or you don't become hypersensitive and overly reactive to your comrades over the slightest microaggression, say, you know, that kind of stuff to me seems to be symptomatic rather than truly a question.
To me, those are somewhat different things. The first thing is a matter of principle on which, and like a matter of principle and the promises of what liberty would look like. And the second thing is basically how does an individual comport themselves? And I do not think that the communism will magically make us all sane. But
no.
But I don't mean that. How can I say this in a polite way? I think there's a lot of one might call functional or adaptive maladaptiveness. I know that's a contradiction in terms, right? But like where like something is strategically adaptive or useful, but like in the long-term development of an individual or a social subject, it's really bad. It just works in the moment.
That's what a symptom is.
Right. I guess. Yeah. It's a maladaptive trait. So yeah, I guess there's symptoms, but they're different kinds of symptoms. Like one is a failure of aligning a principle that socialists should believe in, because I mean the primary virtue Marx talks about is not equality, it's freedom.
Right?
Like that's it's, you know, and so it's really weird when your vision of socialism like doesn't have the virtue that was the one that Marx talked about the most consistently through his entire life. So that's weird to me. But you know, so yeah, I agree with you in that. I mean, I guess I agree with you in both of them, but to me, those are different, like they're different symptoms. And actually the first one's a bigger problem than the second, but also go, there are other principles right now, you know, that are lacking in socialism that really worry me in general. For example, the constant conflation of nationalization with socialization, like those are not the same things.
Oh yeah, those are bigger problems than either of the things. Well, they're, I don't know about speech, the like, let's say censorship through big tech. I'm not sure how significant that problem is for the left in the short term. I think it's a very big problem, but certainly. The conflation of socialization with nationalization is a long-standing problem that in a revolutionary moment would be bigger.
Yeah, you have to make the call. I mean, and I honestly will even say, if you appeal to particular Marxist texts, you can come to, or particular texts of Marx and Engels, not even just Marxist, you can get different answers from that. You have to look at their entire body of work to figure out what the most likely answer would be.
Or at least at the historical context in which they were writing.
Right. Which shifts. Like, we've talked about this before. Like, Marx's ideas, even stuff like whether or not he thinks progressive income tax is good, like, right, changes over time as an immediate demand. It's never part of communism, but like it is originally in the demands that even he put in the manifesto. Later on, he's totally against it. Like, he thinks taxation is a burden on the working class altogether, even in a transitional form of government. So it's like, you know, that's something you throw to like modern social democrats, and I don't think they have any idea what to even do with that.
Right. Yeah. So, so then my concern with Catrone, which I articulated at the time, but I said it in a kind of an abbreviated form, was that with the wrong conception of the dictatorship of the proletariat, we could end up with state capitalism. And to put it differently, I think that's actually maybe even a little charitable. With the wrong conception of the dictatorship of the proletariat, we could just have...
shoot the revolution in the head before it even happens.
Right, yeah. We could just end up with another bourgeois party, really. But certainly we could, in a revolutionary moment, end up with something like state capitalism. The conversations around how to develop from a, you know, core country into a socialist international project needs to be had, and needs to be had in a serious way, and is really complex and difficult just on the level of like scholarship, let alone emotionally and rhetorically, you know. So I don't know the degree to which Catrone always consistently contributes to that conversation in a way that makes it easier.
Well, I mean,
but I'm not saying that I do either necessarily, but
I don't know that any of us do, but I mean, like, Catrone, there's a double step with Catrone that if you read him uncharitably, seems like a right deviationism. And if you read him charitably, it seems like, a kind of shock treatment for some of the left to try to recognize its own tailism. But because when you read the, you know, like, why not Trump, that infamous text, right? From the standpoint of like, neither of these sides are particularly good for human liberty, then a certain amount of agnosticism towards general electoral politics makes some sense. And that's what that article argues. But when you look at what some platypodes were arguing like 2 years later, they were defensist about Trump, which is not a logical progression even from that statement, which was offensive enough to a whole lot of the left.
Well, it's difficult because sometimes Trump would get accused of things that weren't accurate in that were designed to be, they were like rhetorical talking points for the Democratic Party.
Right.
So you would defend Trump against those kinds of allegations in order to normalize him because you wanted to demonstrate the difficulty in bourgeois politics overall rather than just with Trump.
Right. But then you started doing that in crisis mode actions, which is something that...
You mean like around the freaking insurrection or the riots?
Right, around the riots, or around COVID response,
or around the, you know, the way immigrants are being rounded up at the border, or
right, any of those things where you're just like,
or the way the threat of military forces was put forward during the Black Lives Matter or George Floyd protests.
There were things said by certain factions of that end of the left that I think are pretty hard to defend, even from a certain kind of let's break up democratic posturing. However, you know, I'm sympathetic to the whole idea that when you scratch most of these people, because they don't have any principled or programmatic core, I mean, and this will sound kind of blasphemous to some people, because they don't have anything to judge themselves against, even in their tactical concessions to the Democratic Party, they effectively can do nothing but aid them. Like, and so in a real sense, they are Democrats. But that logic also applies to right deviationism, whereas if you don't have a principle to which you are holding core and trolling against that, tendency, and I don't really know what else to call it, or like being a counter tendency to that tendency, you will be swept up in defending a different kind of regressive, bourgeois reaction. And so you're just caught up in, like, it's basically picking two different sides of of bourgeois reaction. And, you know, I think when people listen to me talk about this, they don't get that I actually think both sides are regressive. And they're regressive in different ways, but they're both regressive. I didn't used to like talking in terms of like progress and regress, but I don't really know another way to talk about it. Like, they're not building us towards anything like a dictatorship of the proletariat. But I also agree with you. If the dictatorship of the proletariat's not thought out to what it means, and it doesn't fundamentally change the subjects in it, this is one of the things I find interesting that I raised. Reed King Coltis asked me, you know, my response to that. I thought Catrone's point was fine, but if you think that the dictatorship of the proletariat will have proletarians who simply replicate the positions in bourgeois society now, something is still wrong. Like, yes, you have to deal with that collection of people, in some way or another. But, you know, there's something still wrong about that. And as I have posited to them many times, where I'm like, well, you know, I think somebody around Platypus once said that the GOP was a workers' party, and I laughed at them. And what I pointed out to them was, like, there's not a worker, like, there is no workers' party in the United States, even from a bourgeois workers' party standpoint. And even if you look at, if you just look empirically at the voting demographics, that's not, like, the people who vote for both, I mean, honestly, it almost looks like you have a party of the poor and the very wealthy versus a party of the rich in poor areas. Like, that's when you actually look at the voting demographics of these two, of the two dominant
parties. Which one's which again?
So the Republicans would be the rich in the poor areas, or the better off. Maybe not the rich. Like, there's a sweet spot for a Republican voter between about $100,000 and $200,000 a year in income. And the Democratic Party is like, their main voting base is like 20,000 to 80,000 and then over 200,000. So, like, you know, but if you look at the number of working class, and again, when we talk about working class, we have to rely on bourgeois statistics because no Marxist is actually defining it and taking their own stats. So if you mean the working classes and, you know, the poorer parts of what we would consider the working class, most of that doesn't vote. Like, it just does not participate in the electoral system whatsoever.
This might be a moment to try to shift over into the question of political Marxism, because I want to point out that, again, my trouble with the concept of the dictatorship of the proletariat, as I've heard it articulated by Platypus members, and Catrone included, and with some of the other things that he said in my conversations with him, is that the dictatorship of the proletariat is taken to mean, it seems to me, a transitional state form that takes power through revolution and maybe holds it for a time. I mean, it isn't considered to be like Hal Draper would point out, Marx meant, which would be a temporary emergency taking of power by a newly forming working class political movement or political party.
Right. You know, where the working classes enfranchised solely first, so you can finish dismantling the bourgeois. And by dismantling the bourgeois, you mean basically expropriating their capital
Right. And transforming production.
Right.
Both. Change, you, right. You have
simultaneously.
I mean, simultaneously, not meaning instantaneously.
No.
Right.
But like,
right?
But as a process of transition, if you are not reappropriating that to social production, then you're right. going to recapitulate a lot of capitalism.
If you're holding onto the wage relation and the working class itself, then you're going to be producing a new form of capitalism, which I would call state capitalism, if you're using a state power to do it. And if you are using state power and the dictatorship of the mass of workers through a party apparatus to protect a project of transformation, then that's what I would consider to be the dictatorship of the proletariat. That's what it would be for. And I think that what I saw in a quick read of the essay in the International Socialist Review, which is called "Is There Anything to Defend in Political Marxism" by Neil Davidson, was that there's a kind of political Marxism that ranges in its aims from being social democratic to
some of them are revolutionary. I mean, he states that
revolutionary statist.
Right.
Right. Yeah. The revolution is the taking of the state by the working class party, mm-hmm. and the suppression of all bourgeois parties and political forms.
Right. Right.
But that's so that is not, to me, that doesn't avoid the problem that I just mentioned, state capitalism. And that was one of the major points that was coming up in a variety of forms in this essay, whether it was revolving around, what the wage relation was, whether or not production was central.
Right. Production versus property being central. And also the last key point Davidson makes is the political Marxist taking as truth the apparent separation between political and economic and bourgeois society, which a lot of people take as truth, and which Davidson, I think, correctly points out that it's not true, and it's not even the only form of competition. Like, firm-based competition is not the only form of intercapitalist competition. I mean, I'm sorry, I listened to Joe Biden's speech the other day, or I read it, actually couldn't bring myself to listen to it. And you can already see national capitalist competition reemerging instead of the firm level. And a lot of, frankly, kind of milquetoast neo-Fordist policies being attempted to be justified as a kind of intra-capitalist imperial competition need.
Right. Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, and right. And look, I think World War II and World War I can partially be explained in terms of capitalist competitions between imperial nations.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and this idea that if the economic realm develops enough, then there won't be a drive from capital production for war and conflict, I think is mistaken. That's the dream that is in the movie Network, right? They've developed capitalism high enough and there won't be nations, there won't be peoples. It'll just be the dollar or the
trademark
that dictates the actions of the world in an organic systems of debts and transactions and payments and the post-political world of pure capitalist market-driven society. And that's a capitalist dream, really. And
the difference between monopoly capital and state socialism is almost just a difference in aesthetics. I mean, there are differences, but the differences are relatively minor because one of the things about monopoly capital, if it's developed high enough, capital ownership is so diffuse that you don't have explicit, the capitalist class almost disappears from view.
Right, because of stockholders and all of that.
Because of stockholders who are, I mean, effectively, I mean, like, if you actually look at the, like, the effectively they're mega capitalists, but they're not the ones, like, if you like look at the people who own 75% of the world's stock, for example, they're outside of a few flamboyantly rich people who are actually fairly new to the game. You don't know who those people are. Like,
right. And I was also saying, though, that you could conceive of a world where every worker holds some stock, right?
Oh, yeah. I mean, you can conceive of like a giant nationwide co-op, right? Like,
or international co-op, mm-hmm. right? I mean, and at a certain point, it becomes really thorny to say, okay, at what point, if there really was only one corporation, total concentration, how could, I mean, would there still be competition, and where, and would there still be this conflict, and would capital even accumulate anymore? It just starts to get, my head starts to hurt when I think right. about one world monopoly. But I think if I took the time to like think it through rather than just have that reaction that I used to have to math homework, which is where my brain turns off, you know, I think I could probably think it through. But anyway, go ahead.
No, I was thinking about that. I've been thinking about that recently because of this emergence of rentier capital, or the, like, eventually, if you actually had complete monopoly capital, it wouldn't be capitalism anymore, because there's no competition. There's no, like, you actually would shift to a rentier economy, but it's not socialism either. It would, this is why these debates about that Davison's talking about like, what is the nature of the shift of feudalism? The capitalism is important, because what is the nature of the shift out, and how, you know, how do you stop it from degenerating into a rentier society or whatever?
But I mean, there'd be different sectors within the monopoly.
Right. And they would compete.
Yeah. Right. So, right. You know, and yeah, so they would compete for wages, and they would compete for the price over prices.
You'd have a lot of competition, I think, over internal prices and rent sinking. Mm-hmm. Which, I mean, let's be honest, we see a lot of that in the United States now, as secular stagnation, aka the nice word for the dynasty of the root of problems of fall, continues to kick in. And, you know, I had this realization, reason why I wanted to focus on political Marxism and this debate, because I came to that debate from another debate, which was the orthodox Marxist versus the analytic Marxist. And the political Marxist claimed to find their way back to something like orthodox Marxism from analytical Marxism. Like, they started off, for the most part, as critiquing analytical Marxism by saying the analytical Marxism had a point to, you know, abandon the Hegelian bullshit or whatever, but that they had accepted far too many capitalist and bourgeois concepts coming back in. The example was like John Romer accepting equilibrium in his disproof of the tendency of the rate of profits fall. Basically, that there's no logical reason for the rate of profit to fall if you assume market equilibrium conditions. Okay, and that's actually logically that holds. The problem is, why the hell would you assume market equilibrium conditions? Marx doesn't anywhere. And when you actually look at empirical research on like this now, even from bourgeois economists, they will tell you equilibrium conditions never establish themselves. Yeah. Like, that really only exists as a quote ideal model, unquote.
We have a book right now that's out that's sort of in the analytical Marxist tradition. It's Steve Paxton's Unlearning Marx. And I've been meaning to try to get him into a conversation with Sean Sayer.
Mm-hmm.
I think that would be a worthwhile debate, because he's more of the Hegelian dialectical Marxist. And I actually think Sean Sayer is correct and Paxton is wrong.
I also think Sean Sayer, though, was still a charitable reader of like G.A. Cohen. Like, when I was listening to Sayer's critique of him, I thought like, oh, he's being fair. Like, he's walking through the problems here.
Yeah.
One of the ironies about analytical Marxism is, for all their, you know, kind of analytic defensive humanism, They actually take their modes of production assumptions explicitly from high Soviet Stalinist, from high Soviet Marxist Leninist Stalinist assumptions. Like, that's what their model of modes of production are based off of. And then they try to justify it in a different way, make it more democratic. And so a lot of the nature of the relations of production get completely subsumed or are taken out. And Sayers totally right about that. And
well, you know what, in the back of my head right now, I'm thinking of Pascal Robert listening, maybe possibly watching this at some point.
Right.
and I can just imagine him thinking, oh my God, these white boy academics prattling on about stuff that doesn't matter, but it does matter. I think it does matter. And so I want to,
it absolutely
point, I want you to point out why all this stuff that we've been talking about actually has political consequences.
Well, one,
why we're bothering to do it on Pop the Left.
Why does the crisis emerge in the ways that it does, and how to, why, how, what are the political reactions to get out of it? Why, for example, is a formerly neoliberal hack like Biden throwing out, admittedly milquetoast and slightly dishonestly, but from a real sense of crisis, a whole lot of neo-Fordism at the wall, like
Buy American.
Buy American. We're gonna try to beef up our industries. We're not gonna do it like the racist Trump way, but we're gonna do it to fight China. You know, and we're gonna expand the social safety net so that American business can do that. You'll see these arguments from time to time. Like, you'll see arguments. I remember 10 years ago, similar people were trying to, during the end of the recession, point out that, like, oh, the Canadian auto industry is more profitable than the Detroit American auto industry, actually partly because they don't pay the medical, the high insurance costs, because it's handled by socialized medicine. And
what about taxation?
Yeah, they do pay it, but it's paid. It is actually evenly distributed out from taxation. Mm-hmm. And they don't pay, but they don't pay it. But it is a lower cost of them than the private market that is rent seeking off of them. That's absolutely correct. Right. But you can totally see how some things that sound like they're socialist policies, you could get that are very reminiscent of, like, weird Henry Ford JFK detente. I'm not JFK, FDR detente. Mm-hmm. Even, you know, mm-hmm. about this development of a kind of public private partnership that's different from the neoliberal market public private partnerships. Mm-hmm. Why that would have a certain appeal, because we can't, like, socially speaking, the decline of the rate of profits and the slimming things that are going on in business is leading to hoarding, asset inflation, which the government is helping with, and the movement out of productive capital altogether into, like land investments and rent seeking. Mm-hmm. And that would, if the economy moved to solely that, I think anyone with half a brain knows that you couldn't sustain the United States off that. Like, the United States' whole rentier system is still built on top of a highly productive, if automated, production apparatus that, if it falls apart, we can't do the rentier shit anymore. Mm-hmm. So, you know, if you don't understand these categories, you can get suckered by that. You can also think that things that are very, are not socialist, not good for the working class, are still policies because they sound like they will ameliorate certain immediate concerns. Mm-hmm. You know, and I remember one of them being like, you know, like 5 years ago, me arguing with Tom O'Brien about heterodox Keynesianism before MMT was its own thing. Well, it kind of was, but before most people understood it to be a separate thing, that I was like, yeah, that might work for a generation, but, like, if you can't dominate production or force people to buy your product through military, like basically gunboat diplomacy, then that will not work after 15, 30 years. And the response I got back, not from Tom, but from other people, was, but well, you know, 30 years is a long time. That's a generation, you know, like that's a big deal. And I'm like this is, you don't plan economies based on basically two business cycles, like, you know, three business cycles. So between two and three business cycles, depending on
your revolution should be able to hold up for more than 30 years.
Or even your fucking reform. Like,
yeah, right. Right.
Like if your reform can't hold up, like, you know, when we talk, you keep on pointing this out to me when I sometimes call some of this reformism, and you're like, it's not even reformism. And you're right, Doug. It's not. Because like, all you're doing is trying to buy time until the next business cycle hits. Like, and until you can't hide the contradictions of low profitability and massive production. And because people confuse income and profits, you know, the income of the rich with profits, they'll be like, oh no, you know, there's no decline in profits. And I'm like, yeah, how do you think prices drop? But the only things that there aren't declines in profits in are things where that are not commodity based hardly at all, like education, healthcare. And in those areas, yeah, you see almost infinite inflation. You also see, like, there's other things that you have to deal with in there, like administrative bloat and cost disease. But like, even without that, there's a floor because it's labor, like that is absolutely labor driven, and you can't recoup it through commodities easily. What commodity are you producing in education? You're servicing the production of commodity. You're still part of the circuit, you know, but you're not, you know, that's not something that can be done cheaply, which is why, for example, that's why firms are always looking for ways to outsource their training onto the state or onto the individuals themselves. Like, because that's cost intensive, because you can't do it even with our awesome computers without a fair amount of labor.
Right. So to go back to political Marxism, the reason why you and I were trying for a while, and we're going to return, I hope, to examining the struggle for socialism historically and the different moments, like, you know, 1848 or 1919, but also the different theorists and thinkers like Lukács or Marcuse or whoever. The reason we're doing that is to see how the struggle to overcome capitalism has shaken out and what the recurring problems have been. And then that will also help us to understand current debates from Marxist circles today.
Right. I mean,
because we can see more clearly how, like, you can see at least a thread of a continuing problem within the struggle for socialism, which is how to conceive of what it starts out being, how to conceive of overcoming capitalism as Marx defined it and described it, at least. Mm-hmm. Right. But then it turns into, how can we revise our understanding of capitalism so we can overcome it?
Right.
With, you know, and those two things kind of go hand in hand. So it's like the revision of the original critique of political economy occurs out of political motivation in order to use whatever it's called opportunism, but it's not just like personal opportunism.
No, right? That's not usually what drives big changes of theory, right? That's actually usually like, I mean, it might drive it in very rare cases of an actual leader in an actual state. But what drives a lot of it is like, you hit a cul-de-sac, like, I don't know, the Long Depression doesn't do what it's supposed to do. Or World War One happens. Or World War Two happens. But World War Three doesn't happen. Like, like, you know, those ways out seem lost. And I think also when you're like, for example, the current, you know, Sock Dem obsession with FDR, which
is ending. I think
thank
that was,
God.
I think that may be ending.
Thank God. Know. But maybe Biden claiming to be the new FDR will end it, because people might see how it's in some ways true. Mm-hmm. But that vision of socialism. I mean, I was actually laughing because so many people were like, FDR, but we're also Christopher Lash stands. And I'm like, did you read what he said about the like FDR's move of socialism, like what he did to socialism in the 30s? Like,
yeah,
but, you know, and also you have to look at how a lot of those policies, and they were mostly Fordist, actually. I mean, like, FDR did increase a lot of government employment, but most of what he did was actually get government money to private employers to employ people. Like, it was backstop stimulation. It's not that different from neoliberal attempts to do the same. It is different, but the mechanisms are different. But the goal of just increasing private employment and maybe having some government backstop to stimulate, you know, wage demand so it doesn't drop to nothing, is not that different than certain even neoliberal policies.
My take is that under neoliberalism, there was far, far less concern about unemployment and far, far less concern about maintaining living wages.
Although also under neoliberalism, there was less unemployment. Historically speaking, like there was.
Well, compared to the Great Depression.
Compared to all Fordist periods, except for immediately after World War II. And I keep on pointing this out, like that World War II post-war compact is enabled by the U.S. being the only place with capital that wasn't really destroyed by the war, and then being able to move into all these new markets that had nothing in them because all their productive capacity was literally bombed to shit. So overproduction was ended by explosions. And since we did not suffer those explosions all that much, except for one warship, basically, we were able to immediately zoom in there and help rebuild. And thus we had it was almost like restarting at capitalist year zero with one society being able to benefit more than everyone else for about 15 years.
Yeah.
Like, and what's funny is like, if you think about that, the society that had 48% of the world's wealth and 5% of its population could only maintain that level of largesse for most, although not all of its population, for 15 years. And you want us to try to base a new social policy off of a nostalgia for that? We are fucked. I was thinking about like when you say like Pascal and I agree on a lot from listening to This Is Revolution.
But you guys have the same personality.
Yeah. And
I don't think you agree on very much, but I think you have the same personality.
but when I listen to Pascal's talk, like we have slightly different conceptions of class and nation. Like, well, when I say we agree on a lot, we probably actually don't. But we agree on a lot against the mainstream of social democratic and left liberal opinion. Like we are allied on that. But when you actually look at the fine points of what we're saying, there are slightly different shifts. Now, I don't think that those shifts are like a reason for me to break with Pascal or Pascal to break with me or for us not to work with This Is Revolution or any of that anymore. Right. I mean, like, you know, I have bigger disagreements, way bigger disagreements with Ben Burgess, and I still consider him both a comrade and, you know, and
again, an ally. I would say that may be personality driven as much as it is real politics. But yeah,
that is true. He's a nerd and I'm a nerd.
But in different ways.
But in different ways.
But no, I mean, look, Burgess is. This is Parrot Room stuff. We can't do this.
Yeah, can't get into this yet.
This is Parrot Room stuff. If you want to hear us talk trash about all of our friends and make them mad, pay extra $5 and go to the Parrot Room. So the nationalist turn is happening under Biden. It was happening under Trump. Mm-hmm. The nostalgia for the New Deal and Fordism. That is yet to completely die off, but I think the defeat of Bernie Sanders and the disenchantment with the DSA is meaning that the New Deal is losing its luster again.
Well, amongst a certain sector of the left, but it's actually gaining luster probably with the general public. So, like, if you're looking at like how Biden's speeches are playing, you know, and I am hearing normies talk about him as like a possible return of FDR.
Well, they said the same thing about Obama.
Yeah, I know. And it was, although they also said that Obama was analogous to Reagan, which I actually think was interestingly kind of more true. But it's, there is a sense in which, if you compare Obama's caution and the way he phrased these economic policies versus Biden's caution, even though Biden actually comes from a more conservative part of the Democratic Party, what you see is there is something causing, there is a crisis causing people to reach towards that again.
Oh, yeah. Well, it's COVID. It's a complete shutdown of the economy, which we can't forget happened. I mean, the depth of the economic recession that came out of the COVID crisis is sort of a little bit underplayed on the left. I mean, I don't think it's any shallower than the 2008 crisis, but in 2008, economics and Marxism was on everyone's lips. And
well, you know what it is? It hit a different sector of the economy. And so they'll talk about it in terms of like women losing their jobs, particularly. And I kind of ironically pointed this out to someone. I was like, oh, when Hannah Rosen wrote The End of Men, she actually admitted that it was the nature of the particular kind of recession that affected men more than women in 2008. And the nature of this recession affects service industry, which is disproportionately female, more than heavy services. When I say heavy services, I mean like physical labor service. They're still services, physical labor services and manufacturing. And what I found interesting about this is that I think a lot of the effects of this are still delayed. So, for example,
right, because of all the freaking stimulus money, everyone's savings actually went up. I mean, not everyone's, but as an aggregate.
Aggregate savings went up during COVID. Yeah. I mean,
during COVID. And that was because of just these checks that were coming that were more than a lot of people were earning as income before.
Particularly particularly during the expanded unemployment period when it was its most generous.
Right. And so you had that happen. You have the eviction moratoriums and you have a sense of delayed crisis. And what everyone's hoping is that we can land through vaccination and a slow easing up along with stimulus money.
Given specifically to infrastructure to rebuild. But the thing is,
not only that, but also given to, you know, people that we just all got $1,400 checks. We're going to get another $600. That's not nothing. And I think that there may be more coming down the road.
I think a certain senator from Virginia is way too powerful to let that happen.
Well, in Europe, in the UK, I would expect there'll be more of that kind of stuff.
But in Europe and UK, they have monthly checks.
And I'm just saying that so if you look at the whole overall global economy, it was hit really, really hard. Mm-hmm. But the turn towards this kind of social spending, is a response to that.
We still haven't seen out how it's going to play out. I mean, like, one of the things that I'm afraid of, for example, just even on a reformist view, is when all this asset inflation that we've been doing starts spilling out into rent prices, which it already is. Mm-hmm. That's why we're having a kind of a mini housing crisis in rents and even though
people are getting evicted. Not where you'd expect it to be.
No, right? Basically, it's being outsourced to that whole concentration is being outsourced to large swaths of the country. But like my city is literally the city that's experiencing it the most in the country right now.
Right. Whereas San Francisco rents are going down.
Right. So you have something like a normalization, but for most people, towards the higher end. So there's and. That makes sense. I mean, that makes sense for a lot of reasons. I mean, San Francisco's population has also been dropping dramatically during COVID. So
were you saying before that one of the reasons why the left didn't pay attention as much during this crisis to the economic impact on workers was because it mostly affected women?
No.
It was a sexist.
But they're framing it as sexism, not as an economic response.
Oh.
That's actually what I'm saying. Like I'm not hearing people look at the fact that this is structural and
these two income families, that's freaking serious.
No, it's huge.
I mean, and for single women too, but I mean, and for consumption overall, I mean, it's,
a few years of like what a couple hundred bucks extra a month if you have kids, per kids, you know, per child will not actually undo all that. Like I know. It's one of these things where like I see these projections that the Democrats were touting a month ago about how many people this was going to pull out of poverty, but it was assuming normal economic conditions and no recession as the baseline. Like, so they were taking pre-COVID economic indicators and expanding them into the future, assuming no effect from COVID, which,
and it would pull them out of poverty for how long, even in those conditions.
Right. Well, as long as we continue doing them, which would only be for a few years. So like, right. And they're assuming just like they did with Obamacare, that this temporary ad hoc fix can be perpetuated into the future. Even though it's one that a lot of people don't immediately see. But I mean, these questions about, you know, we're talking policy here, but here's the thing. All these questions about the origin of capitalism, what we mean by state capitalism, what kind of reform should we be working on, what kind of program should we do, how should we relate to the Democrats and Republicans, they're all rooted in what you think the answers to how capitalism development, what it means to get out of it, what socialization and nationalization means, what are the limits, what are the differences, what do you think communism is? Like, all these things are really important for how you respond to these immediately policy concerns. And so when people throw this shit at me that like, oh, you're just an egghead and we're out doing the work, I'm like, but you're doing the work for what, towards what?
Yeah, like, that's it. Yeah. And my question to you, and then we should probably sign off for this first section. But again, in the Parrot Room, I just want to pitch this at everyone. Parrot Room, you get the UFOs. You get us talking shit about our friends. And
you get us talking about Malcolm Swayuna again.
And we're going to talk about the Bellows and the PMC thesis. So All the juicy stuff in the Parrot Room, $5. Come on. You have that stimulus money. Spend it now while you got it. Okay.
The crisis is coming eventually.
That's right. But the my final thought is, we, after 2008, 3 years later, we had Occupy Wall Street.
Mm-hmm.
Even right away after 2008 and 2008, 2009, 2010, there was a turn towards thinking about political economy and trying to understand the way the capitalist system as capitalism affects everyone's everyday life.
You saw libertarianism dry up as being like the dominant position of the Tea Party to like not being part of that at all. Like in those years.
Yeah. But now it seems like everything is a culture war. Like, I've been listening to, Blocked and Reported for cheap entertainment with Jesse Single. Maybe it's just that we all never left the 2008 mode in some ways, but doesn't seem to be a turning towards the underlying economic conditions, but it's all broken up and fragmented into arguments about healthcare or the CDC or cultural issues. Or identity issues, or fights about how to perceive the Democratic Party, and on the far left, whether or not we should all become Stalinists again.
We can talk. Let's take this thing that obviously doesn't still exist because there was major problems with it, and just double down on that harder.
Thanks for watching this Zero Books video. If you enjoyed it, subscribe to this channel and click on the notifications bell so that you'll be alerted whenever we release a new video. You should also consider supporting us on Patreon. Our patrons get access to our Inside Zero Books podcast every week and can get access to the Zero Books Book Club and help us to continue making online content from the left.